access number 11938 to row 52.
Mr. G. Iston, Reel 52. When you reached the transport on the beaches at Sicily, Mr. Iston, what was exactly your own jobs? What jobs were you doing?
Well, after the vehicles came off the brick, off the beach, they came up to the little spot that I picked out, and we continued the dewatering and getting them ready to move off and getting the vehicles away to their places on the perimeter. And before Stantio, sort of somewhere about 7:30 that night, 1930, the perimeter was more or less secure. Only A Company and part of C Company who had advanced in the wrong direction because they were dropped off in the wrong place were the only one company and a half that were out of position. But we're fortunate there that we had 250 Americans who filled the gaps in, so that they had dropped short. I did explain, I think, in the last chamber about the Americans had been dropped short, and they came back to the 6th and joined up with us, and they filled the gaps in left by A Company. So in fact, when A Company did come back to where they should have been, they were out of arrest because they were in poor shape. You see, fear does sort of tire a man to start with, for all you're trying to push it away and all the rest of it. And when you're advancing in the dark, as A Company did after landing, and especially in finding out that they weren't in the right place, then having to come back all over again, they were in pretty poor shape. They'd lost 10 men, but they weren't in very good shape at all. So, fortunately, having the Yanks, and they were anxious to be getting at the Germans, well, at the Italians it was, actually, but they were anxious to get at the enemy, they were quite proud to join up with the 6th. I don't know whether they'd heard of us or what it was, but they were quite proud to be part of the 6th Battalion of the German Light Infantry. In fact, they wanted to stay with us. But couldn't be done, of course. They had to join their own unit eventually.
What were your impressions of the Americans? Is this basically the first time you really met them?
No, we'd met them in Tunisia, but this was a different batch of people altogether. There's something about paratroopers, our own, the American, the Germans. There's something about paratroopers. They're trained to kill. Let's put it that way. Put it bluntly, they're trained to kill. They're not... the British would have a defensive position, but they're not too keen on the kill, on the attack. But the paratroopers, they are trained to kill as attacking people, naturally, because they drop to attack in most cases. So these were great lads, and they were anxious to be doing something. And just before, well, during the afternoon, we unloaded one truck and sent it out with a batch of Americans to where they had dropped in the hills. The plane sailing, they just sailed through our lines and through no man's land to pick their stores up that they'd dropped, but they couldn't carry them back because the vehicles were landed elsewhere on the plane. So when we got their stores back and everything, then they were more or less, well, it was like 2.5 companies, because we weren't 100 strong in any company at that particular time. In the evening, I moved from the place where I was working into an olive grove, not near battalion headquarters, but quite close to the distillery. The distillery, as I explained before, the high chimney was a good place to work. So we moved into the olive grove and found plenty of char and snacks there. I should have explained mainly that you did ask me the question as well, but I didn't put a correct answer to it. We all carried a share of compo rations, which was a compo ration is a ration for 10 men. So you've got 30 men in a platoon. So you've got one box per section. And the compo rations, some hardtack, but not biscuits. not hard tack the way they had in the First World War, because they had those in France, the 6-inch square biscuits that you had to break them up before you die, put them in your mouth. But these were a hard tack, but a small 3-inch square biscuit, or maybe 3/8 of an inch thick. And they weren't quite as hard. They were good. They were good biscuits, really. There was tins of McConaughey's stew, which was a great thrill to us, because it was really a very good stew, and canned. And once it was open and warmed through, I mean, you had a good meal there. There was tins of potatoes, bacon, milk, sugar, fruit, tin fruit, steamed puddings in tins, dried eggs, sweets, cigarettes, chocolate, and tea, and coffee. So these were all split up sort of between the 9 or 10 men in the section, and the QM, I think it was Runciman, he was really marvellous. I mean, he saw that every man had more than his 2 day rations. He was really good on the rations, and I think on some of the platoon trucks there was also one or two cartons hidden that probably put the weight of the LCAs up quite a bit, but if it was all totaled up. But I think each platoon had a spare box or two tucked away for when they did get together. But the thing was that there was, every man had some rations. I mean, to be fair, he might get the potatoes were little new potatoes, about an inch in diameter, and packed in brine. Not brine, but they were packed in water anyway. And I mean, he might have he might be carrying a tin of these potatoes and a tin of rice pudding, or a tin of sago pudding. It couldn't mix very well, but at the same time, there was nourishment there. And the tea was split up fairly even, so that every man, if he did become detached from everybody, he had some food with him. And then, of course, he had his 2 days hard tack, which was a bar of chocolate and a few more biscuits and one or two more bits. But that wasn't used unless you, because it was all packed in a tin, and it couldn't be used unless you had an officer's instructions to use it. Well, unless, of course, you were out on your own somewhere, then you would use it. But I think every man was pretty well covered as far as the food situation went. And he could last 2 days quite easily. And of course, once he caught up with his platoon, they could make a menu. They could have stews and potatoes, or they might have bacon, fried bacon and potatoes. There's quite a number in each box. There's quite a number of small tins with meter blocks. Meter blocks being solid methylated spirits. So you could the tin just fit nicely underneath half of a mess tin, or a billy can, as we sometimes call them, but they were half a mess tin really. And these little tins, the mess tin would sit nicely on top of this, and a few of these meter blocks in, set it alight, and it used to boil in, wasn't exactly fast, but it used to boil, and you could make your tea and make your stew, and anything was happening. And so it really, we were, from the food line, we were pretty well off. Then, of course, once the QM came in, he had loads of these boxes ready for the next 48 hours kind of thing. And the QM staff, they were really brilliant. How we did it, I don't know. Maybe it was an army thing. With it being an invasion, it was maybe an army policy that everybody had rations plus, as you might say. And that carried on till where I stand to, naturally, with being in a strange place. But we were quite comfortable. I mean, we were, what, maybe 4 miles inside the perimeter. The lads on the outside, of course, they would stand to, and then the patrols would go out later on at night and see if there was anybody around. I don't think there was much trouble at all that night. The only snag was that the MTO came around and told us the success for the invasion, for all we'd lost direction, had been a success, and that the port of Syracuse had been taken. And we had to be aware of enemy paratroopers. Now, that was scaring. You know, you're in a strange olive groves, and at night you can hear everything. There's noises come all over. And in particular, we're having a terrific amount of air activity because the our aircraft were flying up to support the airborne troops who had been landed in the plane. They went right over our heads, you see, because that was a part of the coast that they knew there was no flak or anything. And they were flying overhead all the time. So the paratroop thing was a bit of a scare. And yet, looking back at it now, of course, the paratroopers had landed in Sicily, but they hadn't landed. They'd been flown over and shipped over. They hadn't landed as paratroopers, as we said a few tapes ago. I still don't recall if any paratroopers being, not any enemy paratroopers being dropped against us. But it's a scare. It keeps you, it stops you sleeping soundly, let's put it that way. Your ears are working all the time. And I did explain before that you do get to know the sound of your own planes. You know the sound of the Fokkers and the Messerschmitts, and you pick the sounds out pretty well eventually.
Had the opposition that you were likely to meet when you landed, had that been identified, and had you been told about it on the ship coming over?
We had been told that the coastal troops were of poor quality, Italian troops. Which was sound policy in the sense that when you're trying to protect an island, you really, there's no way you could stop it. I mean, an island, I forget the size of Sicily now, it's no, we're trying to imagine. What you would need, divisions to cover that coast to stop people getting aboard. They tried to, I mean, they placed big guns and machine guns and everything like that to stop it. But I mean, even in England, when we were trying to do the defences of the beaches, we had navy guns and all sorts planted, and the same in Sicily. But you couldn't really stop somebody because you have nowhere where it's going to be. So the idea always, I think, with any invasion is that you have a counteracting force maybe 20 miles back. And of course, when we did find out, it was a Catania, which is what, some 60 miles back, but really. But that once having landed, and if the enemy has decided where you are, then of course they're going to put their counterattack in as fast as they can. So there is the worry all the time that there's going to be a counterattack the first night even. It didn't come that night, fortunately. I don't think we had any real counterattacks there. One or two little bits, I think it was some Marines tried to get through, Italian Marines tried to get through, I believe, but they didn't get very far. And really, we were, with only Americans in, it really made us feel fairly secure as far as the perimeter went. But it was the planes coming over that were the real bugbear. And of course, there was if an enemy plane did come over, the AK gunners on the boats, they started a good shootout. And especially the next morning, they had quite a few planes shot down in the bay. And of course, the brick worked all night, the beach brick. I mean, the echelon vehicles came off through the night, the heavier vehicles. And they worked for, I think it was 4 days before they got any sort of a break at all. The personnel changed a little bit, but the brick itself actually carried on right through the night. Early in the next morning, we started moving north through the 5th Div lines. The carriers and the infantry were out together, sort of just proceeding along the road north, heading directly north at that particular time. And we did get a chance to have a look at the countryside a little bit, because the infantry were marching, and we hadn't got the RAC vehicles, the transport vehicles, across. In fact, we never did, because for 200 and 300 were lost in the 4 days of the landing. They just never came. And if they were full, there'd be some stores going down with them. I mean, there are 250, 600 tonne of stores going down with those. But it was quite a lovely countryside, really. It's the first time I'd seen tomatoes growing flat on the ground, just like potatoes, but they were above the ground. I mean, tomatoes and potatoes are very similar, but these were just laid on the ground and you could pick anything you wanted. There's tomatoes, potatoes, and vegetables, fruit, flowers. And the flowers, which we would think were greenhouse crops in England, they were growing, well, not wild, they were cultivated, but growing outside, no bother at all.
What was the terrain like that you were moving
It was
through?
Reasonably flat at this stage. There was one spot we moved into where we did sort of get into the foothills, and then there were some lovely young ladies coming down out of the foothills and sort of heading back to Avola. Sissy is a place where they don't have farmhouses as farmhouses sort of every quarter of a mile or something like that. It seems as though they work from a town or a village, and they go out to the fields each morning. They don't sort of live on the fields. And in this particular spot on the plain, just behind Avola, there was no hedges or anything like that. There was one or two becks, but they were dried up, so they made no difference. And coming out of the hills, there was quite a stream of very pretty young ladies. But we didn't have much time to speak with them, unfortunately.
What was your role in this advance?
Well, I had my Harley Davidson then, with the tool bag on, and as the carriers moved forward, he sort of had a... Where the country allowed, you would get a couple of carriers going in front, and then you got the infantry sections coming down, one section on the right-hand side of the road and one section on the left and the and all the way down. And then the vehicles, the platoon vehicles, and then the company vehicles, they would sort of try and go in between, and if there was anything needed, like they wanted some Bren ammunition or anything like that, they would go to the platoon truck and get it off. And I was up with these people, and one particular place was a crossroads, and I stopped to talk to one of the MPs who was directing traffic at this particular spot. And I was just sort of sat astride the Harley Davidson and chatting away to him, waiting for a few more to go past. I had nothing particular to do at that time. And I was waiting for a few more to go past, and then I was going to ride up the column again and see how things were going. So I sat chatting to him on the bike, and after some yanks came across. And of course, our lads kept marching, but the yanks didn't, they'd just dropped out. They'd seen the Harley Davidson, and one of them had one at home. So we started chatting away with the Red Cap as well. He was talking with us. And I was telling him that I wasn't too used to the foot-operated clutch. I mean, the English bikes, they nearly all had a clutch on the handlebars, but the Harley Davidson, it had a foot clutch. And I was telling him that I wasn't too familiar with it as yet. We had quite a long chat, and then he said, it wouldn't mind a spin on it, you see, with having one at home. He said he wouldn't mind a spin on it. So I said, okay, that's all right by me. I wasn't too worried about him having a spin. In fact, I was glad to get off for a few minutes and stand talking. Anyway, he drove off, and the MP promptly told me that I'd be on a charge for letting the Yank take a WD property. And I just stared at him. Anyway, he took my name and number, 4457030 Orlands Corp, licensed GE, and I put MM on the end just to keep him right, allowing an unauthorised person to use WD property. Well, I didn't stay in Sicily long to find out about that charge, but I suppose somewhere in the 8th Army Library there's a charge sheet for the Lance Corp licensed. But I got myself a bit upset about it, and we'd been chatting a bit. And I started to worry, because there was no sign of the yank on my bike. I thought, hell, I'm going to pay for a Harley Davidson bike, never mind a charge. Anyway, he did come back, and we went on our road to Canisicatini. That's who the name was telling me. Canisicatini. Again, in the olive groves and the vineyards. It was a bit like an English estate. There was a big house and a few cottages round it. It was just like the old-fashioned English estate, where you've got the big house and the cottages round it, and then the farm, I suppose, with a village, really. And we kept the night there, or around in the olive groves there, And then we moved into Salerno, and that was inland from on the road that runs from Syracuse to Palazzolo. That's Palazzolo, it's way in the hills, and high, pretty high in the hills. And the road runs through Floridia. It starts at Syracuse, Floridia, and Solerino. And this was the place that we were heading for. It's about 3,000 yards, two or three quarter kilometres from Floridia. Again, we were stuck for transport because, as I've just explained, we'd lost all the RSC troop carriers. And the carriers were having to do like a shuttle service to get those who were feeling the effects of it. The carriers did a shuttle service because here the roads were very narrow. And as we approached Floridia, which is a delightful little one-street town, and the stream running through it when it's wet, but it was dry at this particular time. There's a bridge just to enter it from the Syracuse side. And not being used to, it wasn't built to take transport. It's probably built for a donkey track, I should think. Not like a Vola. A Vola had been built with straight streets and wide streets. For a Roman legion to go down, probably. But Floridia was narrow streets, and the houses went straight up above you. A bit like you've seen the old photos of Chelsea, where the houses came out over the top and went straight up above. I mean, we had the priests going through here, the Shermans, the priests, 6th Battalion, the 8th Battalion.
What was the priest?
The priest was I think it was a 7.5 artillery piece mounted on a Sherman chassis, a mounted assault gun. Deadly weapon. It was really amazing how they got these things lined up. I mean, with the ordinary 7.5, she was on wheels and it was set on a plate, and then you swung it round in the direction that you wanted. You had so much traverse on the handle, but it had to be shifted around. Now these, of course, they had to be lined up by the tracks, which wasn't difficult. I mean, if you stop one track, the other one goes forward, and you can move the other one back whichever way you want it. It's quite easy to do that. But it's amazing how they could be so pinpoint accurate when they don't have they have compasses, but not attached to them. I mean, they've got to be lined up from outside of the vehicle. Really amazing how they were so pinpoint accurate, because they did a shoot a bit later on for us. It was really terrific the way they went into action and did the operation. Especially there's a little actually it was a French tank, a Type R35 French tank, Italian manned. A group of them apparently had broken through the Wiltshires and started to dash around this road. The anti-tank guns had stopped most of them, but this one had got through, and he was just entering Floridia, and he came face to face with a Sherman. Well, the little French tank, he might as well have just put his hands up straight away, I think, but they put a shot through and then stopped him. And then, of course, once a tank stopped in the middle of a narrow road, you've got to get it shifting. But the Sherman's a monster. It's a powerful monster. And once he gets his tracks up against it, it's going to go out the road somewhere.
Had you come upon any real enemy opposition up to this time?
No, not from the landing. We hadn't done very much, because we were now travelling through country that had been taken by the 5th Division. And they had moved on, and we were sort of moving into their area. But there was a bit of a problem that we hadn't linked up with the Ireland Division, which is away on our left. And that is our objective at this particular time, was to get this road, which ran across the country, and make sure that it was free so the road could be used without any problem. So the road from Floridia to Sorino is a straight, dead straight road, German, Roman type road. Only narrow, but it was dead straight, 2 or 3 quarter kilometres again. But we're now getting into the hills where the Italians were hidden among the olive groves and the vineyards. And they had a good view of the road from Salerno, right down the road to Florida.
What date is this?
The date of this was the 12th of July, 2 days after we'd landed. We had 1 day forming the perimeter and then a day sort of moving to the extreme of the perimeter, and then we're on to the 12th of July. And this road was being bombed quite regularly. Shelled rather than bombed. We seem to think of bombs coming from the air, but we don't have mortar bombs, which I get to be tied up with. It was shelled rather than bombed. And our casualties were reasonably light. There was not a lot of bother at all. The civilians who stayed in their houses had suffered. Now, we had seen very few natives. All this time, 2 days, we'd seen very, very few. There's a few of the young lasses coming up the hills back to Avola, but that was as many as we'd seen. And Colonel Watson, he didn't like that idea of us being where the enemy could see us, look over every move that we made. So he decided that we'd attack the spot into the hills, along the Palazzolo Road, the lads did this the following morning. 5 o'clock they went off and got it completed, and by 8:30 they'd done what they intended doing, which was clear the lower part of the hills where the olive groves were. And D Company had gone through. The A and C Company had sort of formed the line, and D Company had gone through them. And at 8 o'clock the following morning, a patrol of 2 sections of carriers and a troop of Shermans from the 44th RTR under Captain Pringle. Captain Pringle was the carrier commander, just like Captain Cole. It sort of taken over from Captain Cole. And a very similar sort of a fellow as Pringle. And they set off for Palazzolo to make contact with the 51st. They still had about 7 miles really to travel to get to Palazzolo, and the road was very narrow and starts a twist after the Solarino.
Were you with this group?
I didn't go with them, but I had to follow through eventually, because they got in among the hills, and the thing was that the carriers would go to a bend and look round the bend, and if they saw anything they would back off again and get in communication with the Shermans. And they worked extremely well. I don't know why, because there were a lot of occasions where the tanks and the infantry didn't work too well at all. But these, the 44th RTR seemed to have been trained for this type of warfare, whereas the 50th RTR, which we used to have originally, they were sort of desert people. No, I'm not decrying the 50 RTR, but it was a different sort of communication thing. In fact, I believe that Pringle was in communication with the tank commander directly, so that if he went forward and he saw something, he could drop back and tell the Sherman to come through, or tell the Sherman what was in front. And if it was anti-tank guns that he spotted, I mean, they would try to get in a position where they lobbed the shells over rather than lobbed HE over and scuttled the mortars with the carriers. They might stop and just lob a few mortars over and clear the anti-tank guns. If it was another tank, the Sherman would come up and they'd do an eye-to-eye. And the Sherman was a good tank. It was... from the front it was a good tank. I think I did so before. From the back it was wide open, but from the front it was well protected. And in one particular spot on this, the enemy sent 2 tanks down abreast, which completely filled the road. The Sherman went out, and the leading Sherman went out, and or was it? I'm not too sure, because one Sherman had his gun damaged, and he had to pull back. You know, whether that was a tank, no, I don't think it was. At one stage, anyway, the Sherman heavy gun got damaged, and he had to drop back and go home. So another Sherman took over. Anyway, this Sherman dealt with the two tanks, very little bother, and then he pushed them out the road and made his way through. And the patrol continued on its way, and eventually they did join up with the 51st Island Division. Now, the Italian tanks caught fire, and instead of pushing them over the side, as should have happened originally, being British, it was decided that they couldn't push them over the sides while the bodies were in. And I went up there to take the bodies out and sort of get shot of these tanks.
This was your job?
Yeah, well, it wasn't my job officially, but I suppose I'm on the motorbike, I was the handiest to go. You see, if you've got speed on an open road, you take a bit of catching.